The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
But all of these good things I'm doing, including for religion, you know, religion's back now hotter than ever before. I mean, I have to tell you, you know, I've done more for religion than any other president. When Paula was saying that, it was so nice. I was proud of it. And I said, that's true. I told the people backstage, what she said is true. Who else would say that, right? But it is true. But then I said, but that's not saying much, because not too many presidents have done too much for religion. I want to tell you that. Certainly modern day presidents, they bailed out on you. They bailed out. They want to be neutral. They want to be neutral or against. You know, that you have to have religion. You have to have it. You have to have faith. You have to have God. And thankfully, as we gather today, there are many signs that religion is coming back. And now it's no longer signs. It's just coming back. It's coming back so strong. You know, your churches are filling up. You didn't have that 2 years ago, but the churches are now coming back stronger than ever. Nobody's ever seen anything like it, actually. So you're all hot, okay? You know, under the Trump administration, we're standing strongly behind Americans of faith, stopping the attacks on our values, our traditions, defending religious liberty. Like no president, I believe like no president has ever done before. I do believe that. No administration in modern history has done more to confront the plight of persecuted Christians around the world than we have with us. It's a mission. It's actually a mission. My administration is confronting head on the militant and really intolerant campaign that tried to drive religious believers out of public life and out of society. I mean, religious leader, and now religious leaders are respected as much or more as any leader of any type anywhere in the world. Religious leaders are respected again.
Religion's hotter than ever. It's kind of a strange way to describe Christianity or the religious resurgence. In any event, I mean, he's right. In many respects, you look at Amos 7, the King's Chapel. I mean, it's definitely, you know, we've had articles that have talked about the numbers, how many are actually going to church, and the numbers don't necessarily back up what he said there. But in terms of commentary, I mean, the talk about religion and about religious things and about the Bible and about Christianity, it's definitely in the discussion, that's for sure. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily. We appreciate you joining us on today's show, the last show of the week, and we've got some special segments prepared for you on today's show to make life a little bit easier for me. We've got the final installment of the interview with Gadi Taub. That is, I think that runs about 38 minutes or so. And we talked about education, his background, and just some of the things that he would suggest to our young people or to a typical 18-year-old that's trying to find his way coming out of high school, going off to college, what things to stay away from, what things to study. So a fascinating exchange that we had with Mr. Taub, and one of my favorite parts of the discussion that we had with him on Wednesday. So make sure that you stay tuned for that. And then also, being that it's Friday, we've got the Friday installment of World Watch. So I've only got a few minutes to work with here this morning. But to just follow on what Mr. Livingston brought out yesterday with his few minutes ahead of the other part of our interview with Gadi Taub, you look at the, I'll get to the religion in just a second, but you look at the really a shameful retreat in Minneapolis, the drawdown of forces there, and President Trump, as you heard yesterday on the show, saying that, well, we're only going to come back or go into a city that invites us in or that says, please come in. And that, of course, is not what he campaigned on. He's basically saying, if you want to be a rebel city, a sanctuary city. If you want the feds to keep their nose out of your business, then well, I guess that's okay. I guess lawbreaking can go on in certain cities and not in other cities. And that's not what he campaigned on, and that's not what many people voted for in the last presidential election. Americans are looking for law and order to be restored across the country. Americans want to see the cities of America safer. And it's not going to work very well long term when you think of some cities being safer and some cities, you know, not so much. So the sickness, the disease, the cancer, it's still there. It's still there. And we're talking about, you know, this religious revival. We're talking about building great monuments in Washington, D.C., when really we should be talking about repentance. As long as we're on the subject of religion, what about repentance? What about change? What about all the messages that Jesus gave to the religious elites of his day? What about the Apostle Paul talking about this great counterfeit religious system? What about Paul saying that this world is evil? You don't get much of that in the religious discussion of today. There's a lot of talk about religion. The King's Chapel is real, but repentance is not on the agenda, certainly not. Listen again to this from President Trump at the National Prayer Breakfast. I think this was on Wednesday, clip one.
Almost 250 years after our founding fathers took one of the greatest leaps of faith in human history, the story of Emma and London shows us that faith of the American people remains unbroken, actually became stronger than ever. And it reminds us that prayers strengthen, prayers heal, prayer empowers, and prayer saves. Quite simply, prayer is America's superpower. It really is a superpower, and it always has been, and it always will be. And I have no doubt that with the love, devotion, and patriotism of the people in this room and our friends from all over the world, some great ones right here, we can make our country and the world a safer, stronger, more peaceful, and more faithful place than ever before. And it's all happening right before your very eyes. And
the reason this is going to be so deceptive for people is because it's convincing a lot of Americans that everything's on the up and up, that we're becoming more religious, more righteous, that the country's getting better, that we're making more peace. As I mentioned previously, I think when we played that Joe Rogan clip, where he said, you know, I've looked into the New Testament, the Gospels, and I agree with everything. I agree. I mean, as long as it's in the discussion, as I've said, well, then let's get into it. Let's look into the Gospels. We've been producing this Life and Teachings of Jesus Christ podcast. I think we recorded our 7th episode yesterday. It plays every weekend, and you know, it's a wonderful study, and it just takes you into the Gospels. It takes you into what Jesus Christ said, what Jesus Christ taught. And you can know, I mean, it's in the Bible. It's in the Holy Bible. And that's what we need to dig into now more than ever and see what Jesus actually said. I mean, this is the only authoritative source to go to. If you're sincerely interested about the life and the teachings of Jesus, well, then happy for you. You've got the most reliable source there is. And yet so many people don't turn to it. They ignore it. We had this article, Sam Livingston referred to it yesterday. It was in the November-December trumpet, America at a Crossroads. I mean, you want to make sure it's true religion. You better make sure you prove all things, that you examine the truth or what's being said in relation to the Bible. Is it in the Bible? Is it what Jesus taught? Or is it what some man says about Christ? When the morning brief, I think it was Mr. Hilliker this morning, President Trump wants to rededicate America as one nation under God. Yesterday, he announced his intent to do that at an event in D.C. on May 17th. The announcement brought cheers and a standing ovation from his audience at the prayer breakfast. Rededicate 250, America's 250th birthday. We're being rededicated. We're seeing a religious resurgence, a revival. It says it invites Americans to gather on the National Mall for a national jubilee of prayer, praise, and thanksgiving in preparation for the country's 250th anniversary of independence. Listen again to President Trump from the breakfast the other day, clip three.
As the Bible tells us, blessed are the peacemakers. That's true. The peacemakers are very important. But you can only have peace, I find, through strength. If you don't have strength, peace is very hard. And we have strength. In 1 year, I've ended 8 raging wars.
Again, very deceptive, because people are going to be lulled to sleep thinking that, okay, wars are ending, peace is spreading. That verse, blessed are the peacemakers, in Matthew 5, I mean, it shows that it's of God. Isaiah 9 shows the same thing. It has to be of God. It has to be of God's family if it's going to be any kind of lasting peace. This next clip is where he talks about that event on May 17, the rededication of America ahead of its 250th birthday, clip 4.
But some churches are seeing a 30%, 50%, or even 70% increase in the number of converts and also the number of people going to church every week. To support this exciting renewal this morning, I'm pleased to announce that on May 17th, 2026, that we're inviting Americans from all across the country to come together on our National Mall to pray, to give thanks, and we are going to do something that everyone said, like, that's tough. We're going to rededicate America as one nation under God. You know, a lot of people. Yeah. Thank you very much. That's good. That's what I mean by the Spirit. It's so incredible to see it. I see it so much. I've never seen anything like it. In 1 year. I thought it would take 2 years, 3 years, 4 years to be where we are. Well, we've done it in, I mean, really 10 months. We're at 12, but now it's just getting to a level that we've never reached before as a country. But that includes religion. I mean, and maybe that's part of the reason that we're doing so well. There's such great spirit. It's all spirit, and it includes religion. I've always said, you just can't have a great country if you don't have religion. You have to believe in something. You have to believe that what we're doing, there's a reason for it. There has to be a reason for it. We're all working and we're behaving. I mean, I behave because I'm afraid not to, okay? Because I don't want to get in trouble. No, it's such a positive thing, and people are starting to see it, and they go into church and they're meeting people. And families are developing. It's really, the things are happening in our country right now.
Here again, I just want to refer you to that Trumpet article, Tomorrow's News Today. It's in the November-December 2025 Trumpet. America at a crossroads. My father writes there, as you watch this religious resurgence in America, you really need to study your Bible to discern what is happening. It's leading to this prophesied confrontation between false religion and true religion. He's talking about the Amos 7 confrontation. We have to be able to discern what's happening, to discern the truth, to make sure it's true and right and not false and fake. That's in the Trumpet magazine. If you're not a subscriber, make sure you call our operators today and request your free 1-year subscription to the Trumpet magazine. So for the rest of today's show, you've got the interview with Gadi Taub, and then at the end, the tail end, we'll have this week's installment of World Watch. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Enjoy the interview. Going back to education, you know, there's obviously a lot of problems with it. modern education. If you were sitting down with a group of 18-year-olds, they're just coming out of high school, and you're giving them some guidance, counsel on here's how you get a true education, this is what I would recommend. What would you say, you know, maybe take a few classes in this and this and be motivated or ambitious enough to pursue this in your personal reading and studies and then get some practical application in on the job or with someone that could kind of be a mentor? What advice would you give to a young person in this age of education, which has so many flaws?
I'll take this from an angle which I think will surprise you. I teach screenwriting. And one of the first things I say to my students in a screenwriting class is don't be moralistic. You start by being moralistic, you end up being immoral. And also you'll kill the story. So don't, first of all, don't be seduced by self-righteousness. If you want to critique what is going on now, look at Hollywood. They've completely killed the stories because they want every story to correct the reality. And once you go postmodern and you think that the world is a text, you can no longer write because you can no longer experiment in thought and fantasy because everything you do becomes legislative. If you are writing a bad Arab character, you are promoting racism in the world. So you can't say the truth because your text is not, is in the school of social construction, you are hereby creating stereotypes against Arabs. So once you go down that road, you will not be able to see reality because you will have prohibitions on the truth. So moralism is going to be a screen that blocks your ability to look at reality. And if you are writing fiction, you should go to dangerous places. You should, because human beings are not, you know, Joseph de Maistre, which is probably one of the darkest reactionaries as opposed to just conservative, said, he was a critic of the French Revolution, and he once said, I don't know what is in an evil man's heart, but I know what is in the heart of a decent person, and that is frightening enough. So we should remember that we have demons, and shutting our eyes and pretending that we don't is not the way to deal with them. So I would encourage students to go to literature, and you know, the idea that Faulkner is forbidden because he was not, I don't know, he used the N-word or something, is preposterous, because you're never going to understand your own culture's most terrible steps if you don't go there with your eyes open and willingness to see things from within. So that, first of all, be courageous. It's not about, I'm not about, I don't think conservatism is about saying, look, if we all just ignore all these crazy liberals, then everything will just fall into place. No, I tell people, I'm a conservative because I write about dark things. I write about dark things, and I know that it's really dangerous. It's not just fun. And if you're forbidden to write about the darkness, you will not be able to keep it in check. So that's one thing I would tell students. If you're forbidden to read Faulkner, then rebel against that and read Absalom, Absalom, which is, to my mind, the greatest novel ever written. And then construct a curriculum of what is classic, because it is not called classic for nothing. It is called classic because it has stood the test of many generations. And then, you know, I teach a sort of a survey course of political thought, and I find myself, you know, you have to go through the gallery of central thinkers. And if you look at school curricula today, it's tilted towards liberalism so far that it's hard to get a class on Edmund Burke in there. And that's not an objective view of the controversies of Western civilization. So you need correction. And I'm not of the school who said, stop reading Michel Foucault. And when I teach Michel Foucault, who, by the way, is the most destructive of all thinkers in our age, he's the new Nietzsche. But I tell my students, look, this is a thinker I seriously disagree with and despise. However, when we're going to study Foucault now, I want you to understand why this has been so tempting to so many. So we are going to do this emphatically, and I'm going to try to turn you on to Foucault. I'm going to try and show you what is exciting about Foucault, and then we will criticize it. Same for Marx. If you just say, oh, Marxism, this is just evil, then you don't understand the motivating force. My grandma was a Marxist. She was a pioneer, and she came from Poland. And she lived in a tent and made gravel with a hammer in the Valley of Israel in the north of the country in the 20s. And her husband dried swamps by planting eucalyptus trees. And these were Marxists, and something tremendous moved them. By the way, she was among the founders of a kibbutz, which was so radical in its Marxism that they took God out of the Hebrew texts of the holidays. So you have the Haggadah of Pesach, which is a story, which is the story about a story. It's a book about the need to tell the story of the Exodus of Egypt. The actual story is in the Bible, not there. So they took out God and they made it the celebration of spring and agriculture. And that didn't last for long. They returned to the Hebrew text after that. But if you want to teach Marxism, you have to make your students understand the temptations in order to hopefully make them immune to totalitarian ideas which end in disaster. But you don't start by saying, Marx is evil and look at how many people got killed because of socialism. You first start by showing why Marxism ignited this tremendous fire of idealism which people pin their hopes on. So my idea of teaching is not, you know, isolate your students for all this woke stuff going around and just have them recite the thinkers that you agree with. Have them, first of all, it's not my job as a university professor. It's not my job to create followers of Gadi Taub. It's my job to create people with independent thinking. And this is why, you know, I enter my class and the first thing I say is nobody here is allowed to start a question with the word as. As an Arab, as a woman, as this, you're here as a student.
Right.
Your feelings have nothing to do with class. I don't care. I'm notorious enough to be able to tell them, and they laugh. They don't. I tell them, I'm here to offend you. If you feel you've not been offended, please come to my office hour and I'll offend you in person. And they laugh, but they know what I mean. What I mean is, I'm here to take you out of your comfort zone. I'm not here to tell you what a beautiful heart you have and how compassionate you are and I love you. It's not, I'm your teacher. I'm not your therapist, I'm your teacher. And we are going to try ideas that you are not comfortable with. Otherwise, you will not be able to think for yourself.
So if I get everything you're saying, you're a proponent more of a general liberal arts type education where you're getting a little bit of a lot of things so that your worldview isn't just kind of trapped in this myopic, you know, narrow-minded focus.
Yeah, but I would say that my personal favorite thinkers, I would say the first among them is probably Edmund Burke. And I would say you don't throw your tradition away, especially not in the name of traditionalism. So if you want to give your students a proper education, You have to have them literate in the tradition of the West. And that now includes studying critically those who wanted to cut the tree from under us. Mm-hmm. And so we're not going to ignore them. We are going to, or I am going to try and answer them. Yeah. I also make clear what my opinions are. And I tell them, these opinions are controversial in the university. I am the minority, but in my class, I will protect the right of everyone to voice their opinion. I will not let happen what happened to me in the United States, is that one day at Rutgers, a professor walked out on me in the middle of my speaking. I was breathless. There was a control. I'm Israeli, so I might have phrased things in a sharp way, but we read this text that I thought was ridiculous, and I explained why. I explained. I didn't shout and protest. I explained. And without saying a word, he took his papers, straightened them out, and walked out of class as I was speaking. And that was a lesson to me. I will never do it to a student, no matter what their opinions are. You can't turn a student into a persona non grata. And you have to engage students. And even if their opinions are anathema to you, you have other students engage and argue, not undermine, boycott, or label as a persona non grata.
If you go back far enough in the history of universities here in the United States with, you know, the 1600s, 1700s, Harvard, and some of those foundational institutions, even in Europe, the heart of Europe, going back to the 1500s, so many of the universities were, I mean, there was a place for the Bible as a foundation to that Western education. In fact, Harvard initially was like a seminary. I mean, it was to train priests for the ministry, and it's obviously changed dramatically since then. It was probably the same for Rutgers, I don't know. But how do you feel like even in modern education, that I know there isn't really much of a foundation that rests on the Bible, but do you feel like that there should be some of that?
In Israel, I think the problem starts with high school. We've had generations of progressive ministers of education who think that school is about giving you tools, not about giving you information. And the whole framing of tools and information is completely ridiculous. A school, a high school, even a primary school, is an institution of socialization. It answers the question, who am I? And how are you going to answer the question, who am I, in a Western Jewish or Christian school without the Bible? You will end up with a universal, rights-bearing individual with no identity at all. And so what happened is, in Israel, there's now a whole fight, and you would not believe it, but the current Minister of Education is proud that he was able to reinstate a weekly hour, single hour, of Bible in primary school. Some of the organizations in which I guess involved is a strong word, but I support them in my podcast, and I promote their opinions wherever I can, had this stunt where they printed an empty Bible, and it's just the cover, and there's nothing inside, and they gave it to the graduates of the sixth grade who finished their primary school as a form of protest, because some of these kids have not opened the Bible once in 6 years. Now, you know, I on these issues, I guess, more conservative than most, because I'm grateful to my high school literature teacher who forced us to learn by heart poems by Nathan Alterman, who is Israel's Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. And it was the vogue to say that if you learn by heart, you become a parrot. Instead of thinking, you just parrot other people's words. And that is ridiculous. The fact that I have learned Alterman by heart enriched my inner world. It had enlarged my vocabulary and the echo chamber of my associations. And people need texts that they know by heart. No one should have known this better than the Jews, who memorize very long texts for their daily prayers. And if you don't give kids texts that are meaningful to memorize, they will memorize commercials. Mm-hmm. Human beings cannot live without memorized text. This is how they make sense of their world. This is how they build their own ability to use language. And I was delighted to learn that you have rhetoric classes in this institution, because if the depth of your ability to think is the depth of the text that you are able to understand, and when you memorize a text, you own it. And it's completely different than just reading. Mm-hmm. It gives you, language is endlessly flexible, but it can also be a shapeless swamp of single words without ties. And if your brain is not wired to multiple associations of idioms, then your thinking becomes shallow.
You, speaking of books and memorization, you've been an accomplished writer of fiction and nonfiction, and writing is essentially thinking. And given that you have that experience, you've had it for many, many years, what would you tell our students as far as how to develop as, not even so much, you know, there's some writers and there's plenty of other occupations where maybe you don't write as much, but everyone's going to be communicating and writing to some degree. So just preceding that skill, I mean, how would you encourage young people to develop their thinking and to become a deeper thinker? Is it mostly like reading and meditation and memorization, as you're saying? Are there other techniques or factors that you would encourage as well?
I would encourage them to write. It takes time until it's like swimming or doing any other sport. It takes time before you become proficient, but then this is the way to order your thoughts. And in the end, it's an exhilaration. Christopher Lash, one of my favorite historians, called writing, he said, when he writes something that he believes in, he enters a state of blissful self-forgetfulness, which is right on target. When I wrote my novel, I guess it was most intense, I completely forgot myself. I forgot that I was hungry. I didn't remember I have a body. And that is an exhilarating sense. Being yourself is also a burden. The ability to formulate clear thoughts is also a way to transcend yourself. And when you feel passionately, you probably know this, when you write a text that you are proud of, it is something I'll say it this way. If when I write something I believe in, if the thought crosses my mind that maybe my house is burning now, my next thought would be, oh, but the text is here with me. When you write something you really believe in, for a while it's almost more important than yourself, and that is a great feeling, because I think radical individualism is a mistaken diagnosis of the human psyche and soul. You are only really happy when you are able to transcend yourself. And what I said about volunteering in this place for youth in danger is, when you feel you are making a difference in someone else's life, that is much more rewarding than, I had a career in children's TV, so I was like half a celebrity back then, and that was more rewarding. That one girl that I helped with homework, mm-hmm. and that I gradually see the light come back to her eyes, was much more rewarding to me than my celebrity as a children's star, you know, having children ask for my autograph.
Right.
And you're an educator too, so you must know what I'm talking about. But this is what I sensed in your hall. People feel that they are doing something meaningful in the world, and the students feel it, and the teachers feel it, and that makes you transcend yourself, and I am convinced that people need to, it is a personal need to transcend your personal world.
Yeah, that's awesome. One thing we do encourage the students to do when they get together for group activities or they are at a congregation for a service or whatever is we use the term fellowship. Some would say conversation. Obviously, with your podcasting background with Carolyn Glick or Michael Duran, and it's a little bit of an unfair comparison because this is your profession. You're doing this all the time. But one thing that makes it so engaging is just the conversation that can go on for an hour. I mean, this one's gone on for an hour or 2 hours sometimes. What do you feel like that you've learned over the years or experienced or even pursued to just become or to develop the art of good conversation that is interesting? Because, you know, so many people today are glued to their screens. And I guess if they're watching your podcast, you have to, I guess, look at a screen. But you know what I mean? Most people are watching the screen to just watch.
Just scrolling.
Trash. Yeah, yeah, or they're scrolling. So what would you encourage young people to do to just become more skilled at conversing with an adult or with a neighbor or with whoever and not just be so inclined to pull away and to just look at a device?
Curiosity. I think that is, I'll tell you a strange anecdote about my father again. When I was at one point in my army service, I had to go to some medical exam and my father could drive me, and he came, Israel is small, and so you're never far away. And my father was, I don't remember where he's going. And early in the morning, we drove on Ben Yehuda Street in Tel Aviv, and there was this guy opening his kiosk and hanging in his newspapers like they used to do on a shade. Like he opened his shade and hang them with the laundry pins. And I said, oh, poor guy. He wakes up at 5 o'clock to do this. And my father said, how do you know that? Maybe this guy hates his wife, and he loves his hour alone drinking tea when the road is still quiet. And I was mesmerized by this because my father was able to, first of all, not judge, then see the singularity of someone else. And I think that is the part of you that writes fiction, is your curiosity about someone else, about yourself also, but about someone else. So if you're a podcaster and you do long form interview, the conversation is engaging if you yourself are curious, and usually the audience will follow you. If you're bored and you just have a list of questions, then people will just nod off. But it's a good thing that we went off your list a few times.
We definitely have.
So then it's engaging. Yeah. And as for young people, I don't think you need to tell them anything. I think that given the fact that they suffer from a diet of cheap excitement all the time, they have their craving for something more fulfilling. And so who are the young people who come here? These are not people who, you know, just wanted to, I don't know, participate in reality TV and were forced to go to your college. These are people, young people, who are here of their own choice because they felt that there was something vapid and void about the culture where they grew up. And right. So we in media departments in academia have been saying, oh, you know, attention span is just narrowing. And it used to be a 20-second soundbite. Now it's a 5-second soundbite. Now it's a 3-second hook. Because on TikTok, if you don't have a hook in the first 3 seconds, then statistically, you'd be scrawled away. So we think that this is the way the world is going. But Joe Rogan is doing a 3-hour podcast and is the most popular podcaster in the United States. So that scrolling makes people hungry for that long form. Mm-hmm. And they will eventually find it because your soul and your brain needs food to bite into. And you can't just enjoy slapsticks.
Yeah.
But I, for one, after a long day of, I don't know, writing, working, going to university, sometimes I just want to scroll some slapsticks
right.
on TikTok before I go to sleep, because that's a need too. Sometimes you just need distraction. Yeah. So I don't think we need to worry about the demise of thinking, because people will need to think and they will need to feel. And this is why storytelling never dies. Hollywood can die with its preaching and nonstop grandstanding, but then people will look for other places to find a story. And for a while, they found it on TV. So when Hollywood was, becoming preachy and superheroes, they went to see The Sopranos on TV. And if television would become that preachy, they would look for it somewhere else in books, and they will find the text that they need. What we need to do is open the doors for them into these rooms. We don't need to pull them in by their hair and force them to sit and do it. I didn't read as a child. I didn't want to read. I'm slightly dyslexic, so I read very slowly and very, I tell people I read vertically, not horizontally. So I read the same books over and over. I can't tell you how many times I read Damon Runyon stories of, or how many copies of Faulkner's Absalom, Absalom I've ruined. But I didn't read until I was 20-something. And my mother tried to force me to read, and there was a ration of a page a day from these stupid children's books. And that didn't work. I cheated. I pretended to read before bed. And then I started getting interested in science fiction, which I started to read at age 14. Not a lot, but some. And then I started reading nonfiction when I was 27 or 8. And then reading became a major part of my time. And by the way, I listen to books a lot. Since I read very slowly, books that I need to go through faster, I buy audio versions and listen to.
What was it that inspired you when you were 27? You mentioned reading nonfiction for the first time. Was there a teacher or a friend or a book that really got you going?
Yeah, I was curious, so, and I wanted to study history. So I went to Tel Aviv University and I started studying history. And then from there, I began to feel, I guess I got enough of a foundation that more sophisticated texts became more meaningful. If you just dump Isaiah Berlin on a 17-year-old kid, understanding the counter-enlightenment means nothing to you if you haven't studied anything about the Enlightenment. But once you have, then that opens the door for you. And I think Isaiah Berlin, I read in fiction, I read Damon Runyon all along. And in nonfiction, Isaiah Berlin was my entrance because he writes so well. And this was so fascinating that I began to feel that I am intellectually starved and need nutrition. And I started reading books, some of which were not that fun. But at that point, I was devouring them because I was trying to build a larger edifice. It was not about this or that book. It was about, my first nonfiction book, as I think I said, was against postmodernism. And I went through all these postmodern texts diligently because I wanted to critique them. And as you know, these are the worst texts to read. They are mind-numbing. They are endlessly repetitive. My mother, who was a latent intellectual, said that postmodernism will die of boredom. And I tell my students, after I teach them Edward Said, I tell them, I'll give you the key to every postmodern text in the world. All you need to know is this. The question that they will ask is not what is true, it is who decides what is true. And the answer is always the same. The hegemonic group will decide what is true in the service of perpetuating their hegemony. And so in this sausage machine, it doesn't matter what you put into it. On the other end, you'll have the same postmodern sausage, and it will never be anything else. And so once, you know, complicated text by Gyatri Spivak or all these fancy Zizek maneuvers or Derrida or all this, once you understand what they're up to, all this choreography of opaque texts, it becomes completely transparent and easy to understand. And you realize, I call it bibliographical thuggery. They're trying to, or bullying, they're trying to bully you into thinking there's something deep because you don't understand the sentence structure. So Judith Butler is not a sophisticated thinker. She's very, very simplistic. And she just obfuscates this by creating a huge rhetorical cloud that seems impenetrable and full of contradictions. But once you boil it down and understand what she's trying to say, then it's thin gruel. It's really not a lot. And you should give your students confidence not to be bullied by opaque text. Or as Richard Hofstadter, my favorite historian, once said, if you don't write clearly, it's usually because you don't think clearly.
What made you want to focus on history?
I think it's the most important topic to study because identity is perpetuated by a narrative. And look, the Jewish people have preserved Jewish identity despite being dispersed all over the world. Dispersed peoples disappear. You don't know where the Yevusim are from the Bible or where the Amalekites are because they have been dispersed or killed in the case of the Amalekites. And Jews have managed to preserve their identity despite being dispersed because of a book. Because the Haggadah of Pesach is not about, as I said, it's not about the Exodus of Egypt. It's about the need to tell the story of the Exodus of Egypt. So we sit there at the Pesach dinner, and this is the new version. This is the diaspora version that is after we were expelled from the land of Israel. We celebrate Passover in a different way. And that way is we read the Haggadah, and the central theme of the Haggadah is tell thy son. It's actually a quote from there. So long as you pass the story on to the next generation, then the people exist. And Jews are obliged to read the Bible again every year. And even if you are illiterate, you go to synagogue and you hear the Bible read. And we celebrate the end of the cycle when we reach the end of the Bible and start again. Because so long as we tell the story, the people of Israel exist and the Jewish nation exists. And so nobody knows better than us that our existence depends on telling the historical story of where we came from and how we came to be what we are. If we don't tell the story, we will just be lost.
I wish we had more time, but I just want to touch on, I'd love to get your recommendations. You've thrown a lot of titles out there already, I guess. But as I mentioned to you last night, you're probably much, much more read or well-read than on American history than many Americans, which is pretty cool. And you talked a little bit about that in the assembly.
But most Americans don't have a PhD in American history. That's for sure.
It's an unfair comparison. You're right. But yeah, you've been here with us for a day and a half, and I've heard you multiple times, even in this interview, reference your father and just words of wisdom that he gave to you, and how he was not judgmental of other people, as you mentioned. Your father died, I guess, 11, 12 years ago. Is that right?
Yeah.
And you're advancing in age, and it's just unusual to see someone really talk so favorably about your relationship with your father. What was, and you mentioned too that politically he leaned to the left when you were a youth, and you sort of have gone through, I mean, I know the left back then is very different than the left today, but you had your transformation over the years politically and your worldview. But what was it about your father that you felt really impacted you or steered you in the right direction in life?
I guess my favorite quote from my father is, "Gadi, beware of do-gooders." And I guess he taught me that self-righteousness is not an exaggeration of the right. It's not taking the ethical and moral to an extreme. It's a negation of right. My father, I think if I wanted to sum up his legacy, it was that decency is the center of being a good person. It's not about being a saint. It's about being decent. And that is and I think he gave me a moral compass. And it also gave me, you know, as a writer of fiction, that often the great moralists are not so different in characterological inclination than sadists. And you think of, you know, Savonarola in the Renaissance, someone who decided to fix the community by imposing relentless moralism on everybody. So it can be done in the name of the good as well as in the name of evil. So I guess this is what I learned from him, and it's a measure of moderation. So that's, I guess that was, that is what I carry with me. My mother, on the other hand, was very apocalyptic, and I gained much from her too. I mean, the book I wrote against postmodernism in 97, when nobody was thinking that was a problem, was because I heard my mother's rants about the end of Western civilization when nobody understood what she was talking about. She said, "This is dangerous. This would end up with," and she was right, I think. It is a real danger. So, but my mother couldn't write because she was a perfectionist, and she never could get anything done. And my father, in a way, in his moderate way, say, "Don't write perfect books. Write good books. That's enough."
Gadi Taub, we have certainly enjoyed your visit to Edmond and our campus, and we hope you'll come back again.
Likewise. I would dearly like to come back again, Stephen. Thank you very much.
And thank you.
NATO's biggest military exercise this year, Steadfast Dart 26, has been underway since January 15th. More than 10,000 soldiers, 1,500 tanks, 17 ships, and 20 military aircraft from 11 nations are participating in the drill. But the number of personnel from NATO's most powerful member, the U.S., is zero. This German-led NATO exercise empowers Europe as it conflicts with the U.S. over Greenland. German-led Europe is starting to view the U.S. not as an integral ally, but as a threat. Many European leaders are pushing to build a unified European military strong enough to defend the continent without America's help. Based on Bible prophecies, the trumpet and its predecessor, the plain truth, have warned for decades that Germany will form an empire of 10 nations or groups of nations that will turn against the U.S. To learn more, read our Trends article, "Why the Trumpet Watches Europe's Push Toward a Unified Military." On January 29th, the Supreme Court of Panama annulled a contract for a Hong Kong company to operate two ports at either end of the Panama Canal. This is a major geopolitical setback for China and a win for the Trump administration, which has prioritized countering Chinese influence in the region. CK Hutchinson Holdings Limited has operated the ports at Balboa and Cristobal since 1997, when the Panama Canal Authority was created. Yet Panamanian Comptroller General Anel Flores filed a lawsuit against the Panama Canal Authority in July 2025, apparently in response to U.S. President Donald Trump's complaints about Chinese influence. The Supreme Court ruled that the original 1997 law granting Hutchinson the right to operate the ports violates Panama's constitution. The U.S. ceded the Panama Canal in 1999 on the condition that Panama would remain neutral. But Panama gave communist China port control on either end of the Western Hemisphere's most important maritime passage. God gave Britain and America, whose people descended from Abraham, control over almost all major sea gates in both hemispheres, helping them become economic and military superpowers. But God also warned that if America and Britain did not obey him, those sea gates would not only be taken away, but used against them. To learn more about the critical importance of the Panama Canal in Bible prophecy, read China's Dangerous Move Against America. Germany and Israel recently conducted their first ever joint cyber military exercises, the German Interior Ministry said on January 30th. The Blue Horizon drills were designed to help experts from both sides learn to work together, including by developing a common operational language. Cybersecurity is extremely sensitive since a nation's most advanced weapon systems and platforms can potentially be not just defeated but completely disabled by cyber attacks. These drills show Israel's willingness to share critical insight into its defense capabilities with a country that sought to exterminate all Jews just 80 years ago. Blue Horizon is part of the fulfillment of a Bible prophecy that Israel would put its trust in Germany. The Bible warns that this alliance will end terribly for Israel. To learn more, read The Outcome of the Israeli-German Relationship. To learn more about current world news and how it relates to Bible prophecy, please visit thetrumpet.com.